This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Is that what it takes, Doc, for us to finally not be preempted by the Cardinals? We have to call the NFL and get a bye week in there?
That'll keep us on the air anyway.
All right. Sounds good to me. Well, we are back, and we have a very exciting show for you.
The topic today is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement. This is within the lifetime of a diminishing pool of Americans, but one of them is here, and he was a participant in much of this. Our special guest for this entire hour is Dave Tierney. Dave is an attorney with Sachs Tierney in Scottsdale, but notably in his early years, he was a direct participant in much of the early actions involving the Civil Rights Movement in this country. Welcome, Dave.
Good evening.
Let's start out with a little bit of a history, if we can. If depending on your age, the name may or may not mean anything to you, but who was Emmett Till?
Emmett Till was a young man who lived in Chicago, and in 1955, at the age of 14 or 15 years of age, had the misfortune to be in Mississippi visiting some friends and parents. And he was there for a short period of time, just a 2 or 3 week period, and unfortunately said hello, or well, maybe a little more than that, to a white woman in a country store. And he was observed by two men of the opposite race. They were white, he was black. Those two guys took him out and killed him after torturing him, put his body in the river, and it had an engine block strapped to it when it went down in the river. And in 1955, this was all discovered, and it made awfully big news in the South, and particularly in Chicago, where he was from, and some of the eastern cities.
And this was not an unknown sequence of events for the South at that time, was it?
Unfortunately, in Mississippi, which is one of the most southern South states, in Mississippi, that was the way things were in 1955 and quite a bit before.
And take us through a little bit of that period, if you would. What were some of the things that happened over the next several years?
Well,
in the mid-50s now.
Let's start even further back. Let's go to 1890 approximately, because Mississippi led the Reconstruction states in the South in enacting poll taxes and literacy tests in order to deny blacks the vote, the right to vote in Mississippi. And from then on into the 50s and 60s, they were adamant in their attempts to prevent anybody from changing the laws that had been created in 1890, which were laws that were then duplicated throughout the South. But what happened was that Mississippi was famous throughout the United States and all the South, of course, for being a tough place for blacks. And by the 1950s, when the Emmett Till thing happened, which you and I just talked about, by the 50s, things were very grim in Mississippi. And there were urban centers in Mississippi, but it was an agricultural economy. I mean, if you earned anything in Mississippi and you were a black worker, you were on a farm or sharecropping venture someplace in the Delta or up north in Mississippi, and you worked for slave wages, no pun intended, and you were under the thumb of the local authorities, all of whom were elected without your having anything to say about who got elected.
And if my sense of this is correct, and I'm a few years younger than you, until sometime around the late 50s, early 60s, this was a system that was largely invisible to the rest of the country, wasn't it?
The folks in the North knew very little about what was going on. People who lived close to the line, like Tennessee, Washington, D.C., they knew exactly what was happening down South. And if they traveled there, they would see it present in every place you went, whether it was a store, a church, or a public place of transportation, for example, a bus station. You would see clear evidence that there was segregation, rabid segregation, then in force.
And some of the people who first started to bring this to national attention were students, were they not?
What happened was that the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Board of Education, began to raise the hopes of the black population very high, because this meant that education would be changing. And you may remember that in 57, Eisenhower, when he was president, put troops into Little Rock, Arkansas, to enforce the access to high school for a single black female student who dared to go.
With some reluctance, as I recall.
He was unhappy at what he had to do and felt there was no choice, that the law was such that he had to go ahead after Brown versus Board of Education and had to assist this young lady in getting into the school.
And let's walk us through some of the next event. Lunch counters in North Carolina in 1960.
So in 57, 58, the lunch counter sit-ins began. They were Woolworths stores where routinely Woolworths would deny a black the right to sit where everybody was eating lunch at the lunch counter, and they would have a special section in the back someplace, and you would go there if you wanted to get served if you were black. And students from Howard University and then from North Carolina schools began sitting in at the lunch counters, and they would train before they sat in about how to go limp, how to survive being kicked, how to curl up in a fetal ball so as to minimize your damage to yourself when people were beating up on you.
While at the same time not being an aggressive.
Absolutely. This was, you know, Martin Luther King's notion of civil disobedience, but absolute non-aggression. So anyway, as the sit-ins began to happen in the South, 57, 58, 59, 1960 especially, Woolworths in North Carolina, all of them were being sat in, and it was making national news. So students in the North, the Northeastern crescent of universities in this country, began to sit in themselves, actually to picket Woolworths stores. So, for example, in 1959, we were picketing Woolworths stores in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Even though, and then this was the, I guess, the point of some leverage in that this was a national store that had a presence in the South.
This was telling students in the South that we were with them, but it was also telling Woolworths that economically they were going to pay in all parts of the country for what they were doing in the South. And Woolworths eventually did pay. What they did was they simply shut down their lunch counters. They stopped serving lunch.
So what happens next?
Well, the students and the black population were increasingly up in arms about the situation and increasingly becoming organized. And as a result, things began to happen all across the country at universities, and particularly in the Mason-Dixon line, you know, south of Washington, D.C.
Even Baltimore, I think, as I recall, they were segregated at that
there
time.
There were wonderful demonstrations in Baltimore, which is, most Americans don't think of it that way, but Maryland and Baltimore have always been in the Confederate camp.
Yeah, I think that's something, as somebody once lived in Baltimore, a lot of people don't realize. It is south of Mason-Dixon. It did not secede from the Union, but Maryland was a state with very much mixed loyalties.
It's where John Wilkes Booth fled after he assassinated President Lincoln.
This is all fascinating. This is stuff that we hear about. We might have gotten a history lesson about this, but we're actually speaking with somebody who's a part of our history, who is a part of our culture, and who is leading in part of that history. We're with Dave Tierney. He's an attorney with Sachs Tierney in Scottsdale. More about this. I want to get into some personal stories when we come back right here on the Think Tank, on News Talk 92.3 KTA.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are here with Dave Tierney, and we're talking about the early origins of the civil rights movement in this country, a movement that is roughly in its 50th anniversary year. Dave, who were the Freedom Riders?
In 1961, following the Brown versus Board of Education opinion,
That, to somebody who doesn't know, was a Supreme Court decision that said that separate but equal is inherently not equal.
And as a result, having spoken to education, everybody knew the court would soon be speaking to transportation availability, to restaurant availability, and to voting rights. And so in 1961, focusing on the transportation and the interstate transportation, which is clearly governed by the federal government, people boarded buses and went south of the Mason-Dixon line, deliberately courting trouble, looking to break the black in one seat, white in a different place, segregation that was going on buses. That was going on in Montgomery, Alabama, and the city buses, and there was a tremendous demonstration in Montgomery. But the 1961 year brought the Freedom Riders going interstate, and they went several places in the South, but one of the places they went was Jackson, Mississippi.
Well, let's get to the personal side of this. You graduated, to put it in personal context, from high school in 1958. Let's talk about your personal involvement.
So when I left Hingham High School in 1958, I went to Brandeis University, which is one of 32 universities in the Boston area. And Brandeis had a very active student body, and we were always in the forefront of these civil rights attempts to demonstrate and convince voters and citizens that things were being done wrong in the South and ought to be changed by federal law and federal action. So during 1958-59, as the school year began, I got involved in the picketing of Woolworths stores and then lots of other things that we did in Boston. And over the years, I got to be the treasurer of the student union, and eventually in my senior year, which would be 1961, going into 1962. I was the treasurer of the student council. I was the head of the student council committee on Mississippi civil rights. You may think it's odd, but yes, a Northeastern university had a committee, one on Mississippi civil rights and one on Georgia civil rights, and we had people doing things and going places using student council money on this issue.
I was fascinated. It's an anecdote, a little off topic, but you actually booked some musical acts in your function as a treasurer.
You know, I had to sign up a fill-in singer, a startup singer for a weekend, and I went and got Joan Baez out of Club 47 on 47 Mount Auburn Street. She was singing, and she was well thought of at the time. So I went to Cambridge and hired Joan Baez for a startup act. It was $50.
Good bargain.
I remember the evening. It was quite an evening. Yeah, great stuff.
So who was Bill Higgs?
Well, in 1961, December, January, it was vacation at Brandeis, and I was sitting there in the information booth trying to earn money during the vacation period. And up rolled a 55 smoking green four-door Ford, and out of it stepped this 6'2" blonde guy, kind of a hayseed-looking guy, and he stepped up to the information booth, introduced himself as Bill Higgs from Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi. He was really delighted to meet the treasurer of the student council who had his hand on the checkbook. I was really delighted to meet somebody who came from Jackson, Mississippi, a place I'd been reading about, studying about, but had never actually yet been. So in 4 or 5 minutes talking, I remember going outside in a very cold New England air and standing there outside his car talking to him and his wife. But he was there for a fellowship, and he was going to spend the next 6 months being attached to Brandeis as a visiting fellow from the civil rights movement. Bill Higgs was a guy who had graduated from Harvard Law School in 59. He had been an Ole Miss student, brilliant student, had gone to Harvard Law School, graduated, went back home, joined a prestigious and a large Jackson law firm. And he was doing very nicely until 1961 and the Freedom Riders came to town. And he watched the cops stay away while the folks pulled them off the buses and beat the bejesus out of them. And then the cops charged them with breach of the peace and set their trials, you know, a week or two apart for the 20 or so people that had been beaten by the crowd and taken off the bus. But they were charged with breach of peace. So Bill decided he would represent him, told his firm that, and the firm said, "You don't work here anymore."
Hmm. It was about this time you made your own way south.
Once I met Higgs, not more than 30 days went by, and Higgs was going to go back down and do a little business in Jackson, and he asked if I'd like to go along. And so we ended up taking me, two students, Bill Higgs, in a decrepit vehicle, and we headed south.
And at this point, you ran across some names that I recognize, James Meredith, Ross Barnett, among others.
Yeah. Bill Higgs was well known to everybody in Mississippi that had anything to do with the movement, both black and white, and there were some whites that did. And when we got back there, we stayed in boarding houses, and Higgs took us around different places. So on one Sunday, we were in Jackson, Mississippi, and several of us went to a church service with Bill Higgs, and we were standing outside the church after the service was over, and who comes up out of the church but the governor, Ross Barnett. And when he recognized Higgs, he came right over and began verbally excoriating Higgs for being who he was and what he was doing and so forth. And he let us have some of the same. But I was astonished in the most foul terms to be cursed by the governor of Mississippi standing on a church steps in Jackson.
This suggests that his public posturing was more than public posturing. It was deep-seated belief.
Oh, yeah. He and Lieutenant Governor Johnson, the two of them, were really very much segregationist, as we saw when James Meredith, whom I also met eventually, maybe a few months later, September, I think it was, of 62, Meredith enrolled in Ole Miss as the very first black student to go there since, I think it was 1874. And his entry into Ole Miss in 1962 caused the death of a couple of people because—
And first of all, it took federal troops, did it not, to enroll him?
Federal troops. Actually, what it took was federal marshals. And then the governor protested, but Kennedy, President Kennedy, nationalized the National Guard, federalized the National Guard, and put them in a ring around the campus and had his marshals escort Mr. Meredith through the doors up to the registration desk, the governor standing back in the wings and cursing and raising heck all the time.
I think the aspect of this that a lot of people forget or didn't really know or have reinvented it is that President Kennedy at that time was not notably an advocate of civil rights.
The question was, how far could people like Martin Luther King and Roy Wilkins and other people from CORE and SNCC and the other organizations, the Brotherhood of Railway Porters and so forth, how far could they push Kennedy to use the might of the federal government to enforce the rights that the court had started to recognize and which surely would be soon recognized? Kennedy wanted to go slow. He didn't want to lose a block of voters in the South. And the movement was determined that they would drive him just as fast as they could and make him ante up and do the right thing.
So he came along, as Harry, but reluctantly, really.
He did. Actually, I think that September 62 was kind of a turning point because he and his brother, there are some wonderful secretly recorded tapes of the two of them talking to Governor and just wrecking him over the coals and telling him they were going to nationalize the Guard, and he protesting and kind of weakly giving in. And then Kennedy just matter-of-factly taking the Guard and making it a federal agency. But 1962 was the start of just a toboggan ride of events in Mississippi. And when we were down there in February, and then the later trips I took down after February of 62, I met Meredith on two occasions, and I met on one occasion a guy who had become quite a hero in the movement. His name was Medgar Evers, another veteran like Meredith, kind of a tall, thin, reedy black guy. He had been selling insurance when he was a younger man and had then converted over and become an NAACP head of the office in Jackson, Mississippi, which was like pinning a large red target on your chest and asking them to shoot here. And he traveled Mississippi everywhere in great danger.
Now, you hear history, you read history. It's so wonderful to get insight into history, especially the civil rights movement, which we're celebrating 50 years in how far we've come after the civil rights movement. Our special guest, Dave Tierney, he's an attorney with Saxon Tierney in Scottsdale. He joins us for some very deep insight into the goings on through what we have read in our history books and just took a test on and moved on. Now we get to talk to somebody who actually lived it. More with Dave Tierney when we come back in the Think Tank right here on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with Dave Tierney, a local attorney and a direct participant in the civil rights activities in the early 1960s in the South. When I hear you talk about this, I'm struck. This must have been frightening. You're outside of your element. What did it feel like? How bad was it?
You know, I've read some books that make you think about this. It's like parachuting into occupied France in 1943. And you don't really speak the language. You don't understand some of the customs and ways about you. And here we were in Jackson, and the mood in Jackson itself was just murderous. I mean, the comments to us with Northern accents in the stores or on the street corners or in a library or even in a church, the comments were just vicious.
Do you have to sanitize to tell us what?
I really can't remember. I just remember how scared I was at the time.
Okay.
I just remember wherever I was, whenever I was driving, whenever I was going someplace, I was
You were not welcome.
No, we weren't.
Did you do your best to stay out of the public eye, or was it something that you were just
No, we were not trying to attract attention or make a statement in the white sections. What we were doing is delivering materials that were needed in the rural churches, in the rural schools, so that adults at night could be taught to pass the, I think it was 50 question, literacy test, which is the gateway to getting to vote in any part of Mississippi. And you can imagine that white voter registrars in the different counties, these rural tiny counties all over Hinds County, you know, Millock County, all over the Delta and so forth, they were the gatekeepers, and they weren't going to let anybody who's black pass the damn test. And so what we would do is we would arm these people with the answers. And so there was a time when I knew the Mississippi Constitution back and forth because we had to help write the answers to the questions, and they had materials came down in the back of the cars we drove down to Jackson. Tons of material in the back of these cars right down on their axles as we drove there. They would then get parceled out all over Mississippi to small churches. And we worked with some kids from Tougaloo University, which was a black school inside of Jackson. And they had, you know, ways to get the stuff out to the countryside. And then we would go with them or with Higgs. And I would visit some tiny church way the heck and gone in Mississippi, and the church would be absolutely without any paint on the boards that formed the walls inside and out, and there would be, you know, blocks of wood to sit on or stumps, and there would be people with no shoes, and they had not ever had shoes, and they were sitting there conniving how they could pass this test so they could get to vote, so they could have some role in the government of the county in which they were forced to live, work, and deal with law enforcement that was totally hostile to anybody who had a black skin.
What about the white churches in this period? Were they completely complicit in this system?
I don't know if they were complicit, but they certainly closed their eyes to what was going on. The black churches, of course, were extremely active and a great peril and risk to the people who were the preachers and so forth. But I was in white churches in Jackson, and there wasn't any talk about this problem. And there wasn't any, we ought to deal with our brothers more fairly. There was none of that talk. It was just look the other way.
So it was a convenience of religion.
And at the same time, all over the North, and even down into New Jersey and Baltimore and so forth, white pastors were energizing their people to attack, the last vestiges of any kind of segregation that might be still evident.
How universal was that? Was that a handful of activist churches, or what about were these the broad-based mainstream churches that were widely involved, or was it selective?
Well, you know, it was spotty. I happened at that time to be a Catholic in Boston. Catholic Church was not noted for getting on board social matters early, and that certainly didn't happen in Boston. But there were plenty of Protestant churches in Boston that were very active and sent people to the South themselves.
And what was the atmosphere like in not only the black churches, but in the black community? What was it, excitement? Was it fear? Was there a lot of anxiety?
There may be excitement in the North at that time,
okay,
but there was dread, fear, and anxiety in the Southern churches. So, for example, in Mississippi, there would be people in every congregation that would urge the pastor not to get involved in this stuff. Don't use the church to have these meetings. Don't use
on the black churches.
On the black churches, because it was risking the future
of the church,
of the physical structure. It was the church, and many churches, black churches, were then burned in rural Mississippi.
Now, a name that I did not expect to show up in your narrative, William Faulkner.
On the first trip that I was down to Mississippi with Higgs and the other two students, at the end of our trip, which was 7 or 8 days.
And by the way, just for the audience who may not know, this is a notable, notable author.
This is one of the giants in American literature. Mm-hmm. And he wrote about the antebellum South and twisted, dark, difficult tales of life in the 1870s and 80s and after in the South of the United States. And Faulkner's just a giant among authors. And so it so happened that Higgs had been a good student at Ole Miss and had personal conversations and ties with Faulkner. And somehow when we went up to Oxford, Mississippi to have Higgs do some legal business up there, Higgs set it up so that Faulkner invited the several of us, the Brandeis students, to his house for dinner. And I remember being stunned. This was something I hadn't even thought was coming, and all of a sudden it was happening. And when we went there, there were three or four students from the Ole Miss student government. And I was amazed. I had just received a letter, actually had heard about it over the telephone, that I had been accepted to Harvard Law School back in my mailbox in Brandeis. And my next-door roommate called me and said, "Shall I open it?" And I said, "Yeah." So I now knew I was going to Harvard Law School. And it was just a day or two this had happened. And I went to Faulkner's house and met a guy named Jimmy Robertson. He sat across from me at the table. He was an Ole Miss student, and he was the editor of the newspaper and had been a very liberal editor of the newspaper and had really caught the governor's eye. And Jimmy was sitting there, and he said, "I just got a letter saying I'm going to Harvard Law School." I said, "Damn, we are going to be classmates." And we have been friends ever since. Quite an unusual thing.
Yeah. We've got three or four more minutes in this segment. I want to take us through the rest of the 60s, if you will.
Well, unfortunately, in 1963— life carried me away, and I was working to be able to stay in law school at that point. I didn't go to Mississippi, but you may remember that the People's March on Washington occurred late in the summer of 63. About 2 months before the march occurred in August, it was June of 63, Medgar Evers was gunned down in his carport by somebody who shot him in his back from the bushes across the street. And he lay there in his own blood, and his children, his wife came out and found him when they heard the shooting. Anyway, Medgar was dead, and in August 63, I went to the March on Washington and captained a bus that went down from Boston. It was one of 50 buses, and we took lots of folks down, and maybe 1,000 of us went down there. And there were 200,000 people in the National Mall, and
if I could interrupt for just a second, I think the chilling aspects of that story is nobody ever got convicted for any of those murders until decades later.
It was decades later. There's a great book on this. It's called The Ghosts of Mississippi, and it recounts Mr. Byron de la Beckwith and his several times in and out of court and the inability of Mississippi juries to convict Mr. Beckwith.
That no white jury in Mississippi was going to convict any white man for killing a black man.
Eventually, a federal jury under pretty stringent instructions from the judge did convict
him. And this was like in the 90s or something,
was
it not?
Yeah, probably 93 or something like that. It was 25 years after the events. Yeah. I mean, just amazing. So in 63, when I was at the ball, I was there to hear the Martin Luther King great speech, which we've heard so much about this summer. In August, they had a lot of clips of Martin Luther King on the television. We listened to that speech a couple of times. I was there standing under a tree about 200 yards away from the speaker's booth as he spoke. And I had talked to my friends down the way on the mall, and people were still in tears about Medgar Evers. He was a wonderful guy. As the year wore on, later that year and into the next year, there was the Birmingham bombing, where several children died in the wreckage of a church that had been bombed by some segregationists. Somewhere in there, Viola de Liuzzo died in she drove a car to a march in Alabama, and somebody drove her off the road and killed her. And these things really captured the attention of folks around the nation. But as we came up into 1964, an extraordinary thing happened.
Just real quick answer, the I Have a Dream speech, you heard it like, did people recognize that as iconic in the moment that it happened?
I remember people remarking about it and thinking, yes, it was. That it was a striking way of expressing things, and people talked about it.
Because I know he was encouraged not to do that. He was told it was too corny.
A little off script, too. I think
it was an ad-lib.
Yeah,
I've read some stuff since that indicates it was an ad-lib, but he reacted to a remark.
It was ad-lib, but it was a refrain that he had given before. That wasn't the first time he had given
it. It was something he had said
before.
Well,
right. Someone yelled out, tell him about the dream, Martin. Yeah, tell him about the dream. So amazing. So amazing that you were there, and we get to speak to a living piece of history here as we look back on 50 years of the civil rights movement with Dave Tierney, our special guest here in the Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're here with Dave Tierney, who was a direct participant in the civil rights movement, which is experiencing roughly its 50th anniversary this year or next or last, depending on where you count it from. We're going to move on in this segment to talk about how some of this stuff transpired in Arizona. But prior to doing that, I know you wanted to cover one more thing, and that is what happened in 1964 in Oberlin and Robert Moses.
You know, I'll do this fast, but a guy named Bob Moses was the head of SNCC, that Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It's something that was formed in 1960 at the height of the Woolworth Stores sit-ins. SNCC was doing work all over the South, but particularly in Mississippi. And Bob Moses, during 62 and 63, had watched his voter registrar people, his people trying to get folks to register to vote. They were being beaten up and hurt pretty bad pretty regularly. So in 1964, about February, he got the idea to train 400 people and take them down to Mississippi in two flights of 200 each. And they would live in black homes, and they would work in freedom schools, which would be taught in churches or somebody's basement or whatever. He did this training in Oberlin. The people came down in June, and within a week of the time, the first group of 200 arrived. Two guys named Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman joined up with a black guy named James Cheney, and the three of them were at Philadelphia, Mississippi. They were held by the cops and then suddenly released late at night, and they disappeared. So the Mississippi people all said, they went back to New Jersey, and they're laughing at us, and this is a scam by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they wanted to say this was a charade. In fact, it turned out that Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman had been killed, and in early August, their bodies were located under an earthen dam in Philadelphia, Mississippi. This was 3 weeks before.
It was federal agents, was it not?
Yes, it was. It was an enormous number of CBs and naval personnel who searched for these boys, and they found them. And a whole bunch of folks were indicted over this. Not very many were convicted, unfortunately. But the bottom line was that because of the 400 being there and because of the freedom schools and all the violence, the Freedom Democratic Party came into existence, and Aaron Henry took 47 young black people back to the National Democratic Party Convention in Atlantic City late August of 64.
This is the convention that's about to nominate Lyndon Johnson for re-election.
And Ewart Humphrey, both of whom did not want to lose the South. So when the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party forced the Credentials Committee to hear on national television for several days sworn testimony from dozens and dozens of people what was going on in Mississippi, and it was carried nationally, the whole country was riveted. They lost in the Credentials Committee, and the South was won that year by Johnson, and that was probably the last time. So that event, the 400, the summer of 64, the National Convention, changed the Democratic Party, changed the election system, resulted in the South being rebellious, angry,
and Republican.
And Republican. And things have been quite different ever since 64.
Carter and Clinton nipped around the edges of the solid South. Other than that, I think it's been completely Republican.
I think so.
So this is the national story. I wonder, I know you finished law school, you moved out here, and I wonder if you could speak to kind of the civil rights history in Arizona. We're now moving into the later 60s and the 70s.
Actually, what happened was that I ended up after law school in a clerkship and then off to the Venezuelan fields as I did my Peace Corps service. So I came here only in 69. There was a gap there. But when I came here in 1969, as we entered into 1970, a whole bunch of stories began to surface in Arizona. And the first is that there was a struggle over education in Arizona. When I arrived here in 1970, I remember heading a campaign for Carrico, who ran for school board in Maricopa County, is actually Phoenix. It was the high school board, which is a unified school district, covers the whole city. It then had 12, now has something like 16 high schools. And unfortunately, in those days, you could not get elected if you were brown or black.
Because it was an at-large system.
It was an at-large system. And the struggle—
What is an at-large system?
That means everybody in the city votes for each of the five people who make up the school board.
As opposed to a district system.
Correct. Okay.
That's divided up and will predictably have ethnic groups represented according to the districts they're from.
Understood. And the great prize in those days, that's how I met Calvin Good in 1970. He and Rosendo Gutierrez, but those were the first couple of people I worked with on this issue of bringing together the black and the brown community, because getting a concerted effort to try and win one of the five slots on the Phoenix Union High School elected board, that was the game in those days.
The name Calvin Good you might recognize as being on the city municipal building right now. He was a councilman from South Phoenix for many years afterwards.
Very powerful figure in the black community in this town. And Rosendo Gutierrez was the same in the Mexican or Chicano community in this town, too. So I think the next thing that I remember happening on the civil rights front here is the short-handled hoe bill. Somewhere about 71, 70, something like that, there was a bill brought to the legislature which said that farm workers should have protection about being made to work with a short-handled instead of a long-handled hoe. If you work with a short-handled hoe, you work bent over,
okay,
back-breaking. Mm-hmm. It's cheaper to make a short-handled hoe by a couple of pennies, and it is demeaning, and it is back-breaking, and it is making—
You're spending your whole life bent over.
It's terrible on the workers. Why couldn't you have a regular hoe? So there was a bill to outlaw the short-handled hoe, and it brought all the wrong kind of people out, and there was such a struggle. And I believe Governor Williams vetoed the bill after it finally got passed on health and social welfare grounds.
I remember the arguments on the other side. It was, no, they like them shorter.
They like them, yeah. They're closer to the earth.
They're closer. They can dig up more stuff.
My goodness. Wow. Well,
shortly after that, we had the beginning of the grape boycott, and Cesar Chavez came over repeatedly to here. By here, I mean Peoria, Glendale, mm-hmm. Western Phoenix.
And just again, just to make sure people get this, a lot of people nationally think of Cesar Chavez as a Californian. He is actually an Arizonan from Yuma.
He has family. You know, there is a family of his here in town. And if you drive down Washington Street someplace, you'll see the Cesar Chavez Community Center right there on the street. Mm-hmm. So I think the next thing that began to happen on the heels of a very active and very much in the streets presentation of the farm worker problem was that about 1979-80, there was an attempt to change the city of Phoenix's charter to get rid of the at-large system we just talked about and to go to wards, which would make it possible for there to be minority representation on the council. And I was really heavily involved in what was going on in that. In 81, we finally went to the ward system. And there's a great story that's related to that. But it was a great struggle.
So I do remember you also favored having a couple of at-large seats in addition to the district seats.
I championed the divided plan that would have so many from wards and so many at-large. I thought it was the best of both possible worlds. Okay. You'd have some people representing the whole city. You'd have some people representing wards. And a young punk that I didn't know at the time named Terry Goddard appeared and championed by the firefighters.
He was here a few weeks ago talking about the we brought him through the whole district system, but it bears retelling.
Terry and I debated on the radio in those days as I pushed the divided the two-way plan and he pushed the ward system only. I guess the next thing that happens that's really big in this town in terms of civil rights, there's all the usual stuff going along with individual boards of education and so forth. But last year we moved into the era of the Voting Rights Act, the changes in your ability to register to vote, to get your votes counted, to get them collected, to not have to present 18 kinds of IDs or whatever to be able to vote at a polling place in South Phoenix. And we're now watching a court challenge unfold. And the voting rights law is going to be on the ballot. I understand the signatures have been collected. So there'll now be some revisions perhaps by the public at large. And that's a fairly recent feature of the civil rights struggle that we've been talking about.
Let me play devil's advocate, Mike. I know what Mike has asked this question before, and let me ask it of you. What's the matter with asking people to show identification before they vote?
You know, I have no problem with that. Anybody should have to at some point to be able to register to vote, show some kind of ID. The question is how many times and in what circumstances and for what alleged causes must you be required to present? If you have an address at which you've lived for 10 years and you have voted repeatedly in this precinct, why should somebody be able to stop you and demand that today you produce two kinds of identification, both with pictures? There are lots of people, especially in the lower economic ranges, that don't have two kinds of identification, let alone two with pictures. And so I think that taking this to a new and higher and more difficult level and at odd times and odd places, it's one of several things, designed to cut down the number of folks who can actually get into the polls and vote. The people who vote by mail from their home, from a bourgeois community in the north and the comfortable economic ranges, they have an easier time voting than the people who move frequently, don't have identification, live in the southern part of the city. And so that's one aspect of this law that's just wrong.
And there's partisan implications of those differences.
Well, there certainly are.
All right. Well, we want to invite you to the Harvard Club of Phoenix. They're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement, and they have special guest speakers right here in studio, David Tierney and the Honorable Art Hamilton. That's Friday, November 15th. And that's at 5:30 p.m. Registration appetizer, 6:30 the keynote presentations. For all of this information, go to 480-425-2620. Go ahead and get all signed up for that. As always, MikeO'Neill.org for blogs, articles, and O'NeillResearch.com for public opinion research. I can't thank you enough. What an honor to have you here. We want to thank you for all that you've done for this country and all that you've done for the state of Arizona. Our special guest, David Tierney, please come back. We love having you here. We'd love to have you back for more conversation.
Thanks, Mike.
Dr. Mike O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell. You've been in the think tank. Thanks for spending some time with us. This is News Talk 92.3 KTAR.